Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Bringing Design Closer, the podcast focused on discussing design's role in tackling complex societal issues. And our goal is to have conversations that inspire and help move the dial forward for organizations to become more human-centered in their approach to solving complex business and societal problems. Look, it's the start of 2022. I can't believe it. And I want to ask a favor before we jump into this episode. Now, if you haven't already done it, sign up to our newsletter on thisis8cd.com, where you get fortnightly content about all that is going on in the world of This Is 8CD, such as the Doing Design Festival, which is happening very, very soon. And also, if you love what we do, please leave a rating for the podcast on Apple or Spotify or Google or any other platform that you use to listen to the podcast on. This helps us out enormously. It may seem something so simple, but it really helps us out enormously and helps others find the podcast too. So that really helps us and goes a long way. So my name is Jerry Scullion. As you probably know at this stage, I'm a service designer. I'm the founder of This Is 8CD and the CEO of thisisdoing.com, where we provide live online design and innovation classes, transformational design and innovation training for teams and organizations, for people within the design and the change-making space. Now, in this episode, I speak with one of my colleagues at thisisdoing.com, one of the co-authors of This Is Service Design Doing book, Marcus Edgar Hormez. And Marcus's name is one that will probably be synonymous with the word service design and be very familiar to people within the service design community. But nevertheless, let me tell you a little bit about Marcus today. He's my guest. Marcus is based in Germany. He's a trained physicist and he's a partner at Workplay Experience. And I look to Marcus for many things, not only just technical advice and actually how to set up a podcast. He's brilliant at that. But I also align with his deep-rooted passion with prototyping of services and just prototyping in general. The bits that can so easily be trivialized or just assumed are those moments that are missed within teams and organizations. And we chat at length about how to encourage prototyping generally within your organization. So it's a really good episode. And we speak more around play and what this means. And like maybe what's the opposite of playfulness look like within organizations? And again, how can we move the dial to become more likely to lean into the prototyping mindset? Anyway, it's a great one. I know you're going to enjoy Marcus's my conversation. So let's jump straight into it. Marcus Edgar Hormez, a very warm welcome to Bringing Design Closer. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you for having me. Hey. Hey, Terry.
Marcus, we've known each other for a number of years and we've got the pleasure of working together, obviously, with This Is Doing. But for our listeners who maybe aren't familiar with Marcus Edgar Hormez, how do you describe yourself and tell us what you do?
Oh, that's
in about 50 words or less.
50 words or less. That's one thing I can't do. You know, I'm famous for talking too much, possibly.
No.
Yeah, 50 words or less. Let's try this. I'm a physicist by training, turned to the dark side, consultant, swapped into service design early on at the intersection of business design and technology. I really like to integrate that stuff. And prototyping is the thing that I like to talk about most. Building things, using technology to build things, using people. Well, not using people, but working with people to make things happen or almost anything. Yeah.
Using people as props.
No, not so much. This is the interesting thing. I just noticed this the other day. Sometimes we say, you know, what's the medium of a service designer?
Yeah.
And it's the organization. So by organization, our people, are people the medium? Because, you know, we should work with them and not change them. Anyway, but this is what we do, you know, most of the time.
Yeah.
The semantics. So
absolutely. And you are one of the authors of This Is Service Design Doing. So for people out there who haven't heard of the This Is Service Design Doing book, it's I don't know how many years old is it. 2022. It's published in 2018. It's 4 years old, is it?
It's
it's four. It's a toddler. Hopefully, it's been toilet trained.
It's not the age where they lie on the floor and totally resist everything that you try them to
they kick and stomp, develop personalities of their own.
Yeah.
But look, you know, we were chatting and we've been chatting about doing this podcast for definitely a couple of years. And it's great that I've completed the sort of the quartet. I've got Jakob, I've got Mark, I've got Adam on the podcast, of course. And now we've got you. So that's it. You know, we can close This Is HCD down. But we were always been chatting about prototyping, especially with This Is Doing. We work together, delivering training and stuff. But playfulness off the back of that is something that I know I've encountered quite a lot over the last number of years, and one of the sort of the side benefits of prototyping. So you mentioned there that your interest in service design or prototyping comes from within service design. How did that happen? Walk me through your background on what brought you to the world of prototyping. What interests you so much about it?
That's a very good question. I always think us are really interested in possibility. And, early on, I've got a degree in science. So technology always was something that I was interested in, and observing new technologies and what they can do or what they can't do was really something I was fascinated by.
I was going to say, does it come from a place, do you find, from the scientific background of that whole kind of testing and, you know, wanting to make sure that you're not going too far ahead and then having to come back on yourself? Is there something in the scientific mindset that lends itself to the prototyping mindset?
I'm not sure if there is a huge difference. And I think the communities see a big difference. They are rarely being able to talk to each other, like scientific community or the design community. And these are bridges that we might have to build. But if you look at the scientific method and the design approach, it's not, you know, on some core values, it's not that different. It's about trying out things, not just thinking about stuff, but doing experiments. Doing many experiments, trying to learn how things work, and then build something on top of it. And so on a very simple basis, it's very similar. And we can learn a lot from the scientific community in terms of, you know, this experimentation mindset. And one of the things that I learned already at university was when I was trying to write my thesis, you know, I was trying to understand how phase transitions worked at the time. And in the end, you try so many ways to solve that problem that you were given. And you learn so much what doesn't work, right? And then it's like you start with an empty piece of paper that is your map. And you walk a couple of steps, and then you, like a cartographer, you map out what works, what doesn't work, and what the path is. And then in your thesis, you just write up that one path that worked. But you learn so much along the way. And I think that's a similar thing in design when you're trying to figure out how to build something that works for our customers, for the stakeholders, for the employees in the end. We can't just put in a perfect solution. We also need to learn about all these kind of sideways, these little detours that don't work, because we need to avoid them, and we need to learn when they happen what to do, or how to recover that. So a perfect concept, even if it works, is not worth it. It's not worth a lot unless you kind of also know what kind of terrain you're in, if I want to stay with that metaphor.
Just sticking on that for a little bit more, like, you know, when we talk about prototyping, I think myself and yourself have a similar kind of understanding of what we mean. But in my experience of speaking to teams and we're delivering training and stuff, prototypes tend to be compressed into this kind of understanding of it being a either a paper prototype or a digital prototype on the screen where they click through things. How do you describe what a prototype is? Just so we've got that shared understanding and listening with the listeners.
I think it's one of these cases where the language gets in the way. It's a very natural, prototyping is a very natural concept. It's part of how we learn, especially in the field of service design. How do you learn a language, right? You learn a couple of sentences, you try it in front of people, you know, it fails or not, and then you get corrected, and then you try again. And you try again until it works, you know, and you can communicate. Yeah. And, you know, when kids learn to ride a bicycle, they ride the bicycle. Well, they don't. They try. They fall. They get up again and, you know, they try again until it works. Every try is kind of a prototype. It's an early version of where you want to go. And we learn along the way, because the most important thing about prototyping is you try something out. And then you learn from it, and then you try to improve. But it's not about thinking about something, not trying it out in your head, but trying it out in the real world. And prototyping, like historically, has the terminology was used mainly in product design or industrial design when you built an object. I think looking at the world from a service perspective, you know, it's all about the experience. And so how do we prototype these experiences? And that's everything which is out there. So it can be a consulting experience that needs to be prototyped. You know, the communication needs to be prototyped, all that kind of stuff. A conversation can be prototyped, all these experiences. And basically a prototype is trying it out and see what happens. And learning from it, I think that's the key thing. So you build a prototype, you set something up, you try it, and you observe and learn from it. I think these are the important steps.
I mean, within teams and organizations that have kind of come from this waterfall mindset where they might have had a document created at the start with all the requirements in it, and they know exactly what they're doing. And then I'm being a bit kind of facetious there. And then they'll have some sort of screen design session and all the requirements and the functional requirements will be thrown against that. And then someone might come and say, well, we need to usability test this stuff. And then they start creating a series of interactive wireframes and they're like, okay, cool. Where do you see prototyping sit? Like if that's a typical scenario for an organization, that might be, I don't know, on the journey to becoming more agile in their approaches of ways of working. That, to me, sounds very similar to how organizations wrap the word prototyping up into their ways of working. I'm kind of keen to get your understanding of how they should probably explore it.
I think that the first word I said where I jumped on was the requirements document. You know, let's burn that and replace it with a prototype. I think as simple as that. There is few people that understand requirements documentations, right? That's the people writing it. I think that's about it in my experience. And there is so much lost.
And I need to stop you there because there's probably people in there in flames. They're kind of going, burn the requirements document. Like that's replace it with a prototype. All right, replace what with a prototype? How do you know what to prototype? Those requirements are coming from policy and they're coming from regulation and these are mandated and they need to be included in the design. What do you say to people when they kind of, you know, I wouldn't be the first designer to say, you know, go against the requirements document.
Of course. I mean, you know, the reality is, I mean, I say it in that way because I want people to listen. Because the first thing, a lot goes wrong with requirements documents, especially the first is the people that often get asked for requirements aren't people that can formulate them very well in this moment. And they just give you a list. It's a wish list. Sometimes they need it. Sometimes they don't really need it and they don't know that. So a lot of things go wrong. And we know all this, you know, all these problems with requirements documents. Yeah. And the second thing is then someone else reads it and it's kind of a handover. So it takes out a conversation that we in service design and in design replace by going out there and doing contextual research. So we look at what people need. And then, of course, it makes sense to kind of compile all that learning into maybe a document so we don't forget. However, if we now go on to say, now let's move to the developers and have this thing done, if we're talking about a digital product or service, then there is this document. Why not flank it with a first prototype to say, this is what we mean by all these requirements? And, you know, this is our first vision, how this could feel like, how this could work. This actually solves our problem before they go into the details and solve all these deep technical problems that might be associated with it. So it helps people to understand what's in this other document.
Okay, so is there a way that we can, rather than burn the requirements document, because that could be seen as a very antagonizing approach to trying to working with part of the business. But is there a way to, and have you seen ways where they can take that requirements document and maybe explore its reevaluation?
I think in the end, maybe the document isn't the source of the problem. It's how the work is stacked up in a project with the handovers.
Yeah,
because often that document is there because, you know, we get the requirements from one part of the organization and some other part has to do it. And they don't necessarily talk to each other. They just hand over that. You know, it's everything in this document.
And then they walk away.
So then they walk away. And people are kind of, okay, you can't document everything that you learned, you know, when you do research. So, and certainly, even if you capture all the technical details, all the empathy, the why this is important is lost when you hand over a document. So can we please have some of the developers maybe, or someone from the development community also join the research so they know what the insights mean, that they know why it's such a problem for the users, for the people in the context, you know, being out there in the in-home interviews, whatever it is. So there is at least a piece of empathy and they can raise their hands and say, okay, this is the requirement, but this is how you need to read it because I've been out there, man.
Yeah. Shared ownership and also research to swim a little bit further upstream to help co-create those requirements. If this is like this, we're not saying this is the best case scenario. Okay. We're just saying like if you're in a scenario like that, that would be one way to potentially look at approaching it and trying to sort of permeate that, you know, that sort of skin of the organization where it's very protective of these kind of rituals that tends to persist. So just going back to the prototyping thing over, imagine like they're doing that and they've got these, they've got a digital prototype. Let's just be clear. Like, you know, when we work together before, we tend to explore, conversational prototyping and stuff that comes from that. Why would somebody approach prototyping from a conversational perspective? What are the benefits of working in this way? And I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit.
Because it's fast, right? There is a huge bias in design.
And it's fun.
It's fun. Yeah, it's fun. Yeah, and it's fast. The thing is, just take a timer and time the time it takes for you to sketch a certain interface or a certain interaction. And then think about, okay, so this is the interaction. If a human now would replace that interaction, you know, if we had a employee doing this instead of an app, right? How would that conversation work?
Hmm.
And so if we do that, then, and you time the conversation and you use kind of improv theater techniques, you know, you just, you know, you play around with this and you say, okay, I'm the employee doing the service for you, maybe a, you know, travel advice or some, you know, navigational stuff, for your holiday. Then we can just have a conversation. Imagine you have to draw all this in a user interface. And how long would it take? And this is one of the things. Prototyping tries to maximize learning. And we can go through so many different variations in a conversation much more quickly than we can drawing it out. At some point, of course, we need to make a decision. So what is kind of the channel that we want to have this in? Will this be an app? Will this be a website? Should this be the call center taking that part? But this is one of the things. You don't always have to prototype in the same channel. It depends on what question, what you want to learn. Sometimes you need to build prototypes that actually allow you to make that decision. Does that need to be an app at all? And this is something that is not happening because we always know we need to build that app. And so these kind of lightweight tools allow us to step back and say, let's forget that for a moment. Yes, we will come back to that, of course, and 90%. Yeah. We'll go into there, but we also might discover some really interesting questions.
So to reframe that a little bit more, I really want to touch on this a little bit more around the point that you made there around that you already know that you're doing an app. So you're prototyping an app. Whereas if you prototype much earlier in the process, there's a higher chance that you can have more input into what goes into the app or what maybe could be other part of the service, could be, you know, paper, or it could be wayfinding, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Too often prototyping happens too late is what we're seeing. Like, you know, prototyping is more an usability testing. But on the point of you mentioned about it being fast and I mentioned about it being fun. Is that safe to say that fun makes for a better kind of experience in the long run? Why should fun enter in the conversation when we're working?
I think it's about the energy in the room. If you've seen prototyping sessions, we work with a huge medical engineering company, and you know it was a 3-day workshop where they explored new services, a new service portfolio. What could they do in like 2 to 3 years? And I think after 6 hours, we had, you know, all the PhDs in the room on the floor playing with Lego and setting up basically huge ecosystems that they walked through, like, and to understand where they stand and where they could make a difference. When we introduced it, you could see them kind of looking over to the big boxes of prototyping materials that we brought, and they were just waiting for it to be opened, like a box, and then just you couldn't hold them back. And that this is the energy, especially in that field. And this has to do with the safe space that you create around these things. You know, this was about partially about cancer research and treatments. And we had people in the room to bring that empathy. So they had a history. And so we had to balance this kind of energy. We needed to be honest and careful that we can say, okay, you know, we do something for a very serious cause. And we need to be on eye level with all these people and treat them in the right way. At the same time, we need to create that kind of emotional safe space for us so that we can come up with ideas and new solutions and have some having fun and being playful around these things without forgetting why we're doing this, I think is the trick here. So but it creates that safe space, and we've done a similar project just last year where it was, you know, also again mental health and with students, and that was one of the topics. But in the project itself, we used prototyping, we used quite light-hearted methodologies to manage kind of the engagement in the room. And I think it needs both. Otherwise I'm pretty sure it's not as productive, or you know, we don't get to the solution that we got to.
What's the antithesis of fun in the workplace?
I don't know. The absence of fun sounds really Sounds
so
depression.
It's so it's so miserable. But like,
yeah, the thing is, fun. I'm not a big fan of the word fun, because it, you know, I like to have fun, but there, it's also playful. Something that is maybe meaningful fun sometimes.
Yeah,
my mindless fun is necessary to kind of get away from something for a moment.
Mm. Mindful and connected, yeah. And
but then getting back to that place, you know, it's a bit like in a meditation, you know. So you notice that, you know, you're in need of something, and you see that, yeah. In when I was younger, I was working for a social service, and there being with the nurses, we had a bad day. You know, you wouldn't believe the jokes they cracked, and I was like, "Can you do that? Is that important?" And it was just, you know, why this is. Oh, and it took me a while to understand that this is, you know, they're building themselves that safe space to cope with these things. And then they got very serious again, of course, and they took all the patients very seriously, and they taught me that there is this kind of front stage, backstage in this, in this field, but they need to take care of themselves so they can take care of other people.
Yeah, it's funny, whenever I've worked with people who work with vulnerability in the medical space, whenever I introduce to them prototyping or investigative rehearsals, they take to it like a duck to water. I don't have to sell it to them, okay? And I think it's because of their ability to build a safe space amongst themselves much quicker than a traditional organization. And the traditional organizations I refer to as the ones that tend to have somewhat of a closed mindset. It's very much control and command kind of at the center of how they work. And they struggle with the idea. I always feel like I have to sell this to them, like, you should try this. And they're like, well, why? What? Why? So most of the questions that I get from listeners are from that mindset. They're in those organizations. They want to change things. And they struggle, like, with stakeholders when they say, we're going to try prototyping earlier in the process, and also we're going to do something that could be seen as having fun or more playful approaches. How have you handled that in the past? Is that something you can discuss?
This is a tough one. I was just reminded of a workshop that was years and years ago, and it was the first time I noticed these kind of inner blockades when people stop working on something. And I think this is something that you see in bigger organizations. It's, I have my idea now, I put it in a PowerPoint deck, and this is what I can do.
Yeah.
And now someone else needs to do more. And so we did a 2-day workshop, I think it was automotive, and they were trying to map out a technology roadmap for the next 5 to 10 years. And they brought together lots of people from all around the world to join in and to kind of align. And we used prototyping for them to actually build that kind of vision of the future.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really interesting, because there is a certain... So yes, they would be building cardboard prototypes. They would use kind of walkthroughs and you know, do all these simulations. But that was really hard. Then they thought, yeah, this is it. This is now. And it was really hard to do the next step, to go deeper and actually prototype more. And this barrier is this. Now, I think it mirrors maybe all these kind of silos that you have inside organization. Now it's someone else's problem that you have, or this tiny prototype, this inkling of a starting point. It stops it. Because then you give it to someone, you explain it, and then someone does it, but it's not their thing. So how can we actually help people to learn that they can do more? And this is something that I'm I've been pushing for the last 15 years or so, really is trying to say, guys, in this world, with the technology that we have, with, you know, the communication infrastructure we had, you can build almost anything yourself if you want to. You know, you find all the instructions on the internet, you hook up to the communities that help you build it. A lot of technology is there that helps you build stuff. You know, if, for example, if you want to build digital products, all the whole no code and low code movement is out there. I mean, you can build things today that you needed engineers for, like a whole team of engineers for 10 years ago.
I mean, look at
you
this.
You can do AI stuff yourself right now. Just putting stuff, you know, building bricks together. It's like Lego. Yes, there is a learning curve, but if you really wanted it, yes, you can. And there's lots of accounts out there. The same in building like physical products. There is, you know, I started the Fab Lab here in Nuremberg, which is kind of makerspace that allows you to build almost anything. You know, so there's 3D printers, laser cutters, a digital like an electronic workbench, and you know, there's 10-year-olds that just use that stuff every day.
Yeah.
And hell, why should a 35-year-old guy in a company not be able to kind of pull all these things together and make something?
A mashup,
And I think that's the limiting thing. We need to, and this is, there's a lot of things you can talk about. And I, as you notice, I talk a lot about these things. But that doesn't convince people. They need to experience that. They need to experience that, wow, I just built something with AI, right? Wow, I just built an app and I can't even program. Wow, boom, right? And you need to experience these things by building it, building stuff. And then you get more proficient in it. And of course, at some point, you need to hand it over to someone who takes it further, right? But this point happens later than we often believe. Because if it happens too early, you know, if it's just something in a PowerPoint slide, then you have to do all that convincing.
Yeah.
You know, all that, oh, we need to build a good storyline. Because that's all, you know, these are all evidences of I have to sell something. I have to convince somebody. A prototype sometimes does that job for you without you having, because people can try it and they see, ooh, that works. That's amazing. Here's even feedback from real customers using that thing and being, so you don't need to put together that kind of super flashy storyline anymore.
No. And I typically in businesses, whenever we talk about the value of prototyping and prototyping earlier, you can lean on the fact that you're reducing risk and increasing certainty in what you're building is the right thing. And if they have an argument with that, what's their argument like? How can they match this? There's very few other things that I've ever heard of, none that come to mind actually as I'm saying it. Prototyping can give you so much bang for buck.
Absolutely. I mean, this, and again, this is not new, right? In the, if you look, I worked with in the automotive industries 20 years ago, and the at the time, they're calling this front loading, trying to just iterate earlier, not just in the half year or a couple of months before the launch of a new car, right? They try to iterate much earlier. So because there, earlier in the design phase, in the development, it was just cheaper to fix the problems, much cheaper, because there's so many people having to that need to collaborate to make this thing happen. You know, as soon as you make changes late, of course you have to tell everybody, and it's just like the cost of that change, becomes massive if you're unlucky. And
absolutely.
And there is heaps of literature on this. This is what Toyota way was from the beginning. So they iterated, you know, early, much earlier. So lots of design changes in the early stages of development. And then, yes, there was a little bump of design changes just before start of production. Right. But, you know, and now this was all about the car, and the same thing now happens to all the services and experiences. Mm-hmm. We're just not used to thinking about them in the same way.
Yeah.
The Munich Airport did a huge test run for their new terminal, where they, you know, they sent thousands or I don't know, hundreds of customers with cards, you know, little task cards into the new terminal, testing all the services that were there. But this was just, you know, a couple of months before, no, just very shortly before they were opening it, just to stress test that. And everybody is doing these pilots, right? Everybody's doing pilots because they don't want to have their big service fail when they open the doors.
Absolutely.
However, people are not doing this early enough. And, you know, this is where prototyping, again, you know, can be of huge value when you bring together the team that's interdisciplinary and you start with a prototyping workshop. You start the project with a prototyping workshop.
Mm.
Why would you do this? Because prototypes don't need language. And if, you know, we did this with lawyers and designers about regulation. Yeah. And these are two kind of, and people from the public space, they know this. This is a hard gap that you need to cross. Yeah. And it's getting better. And there's more and more people that can, you know, they understand each other. And, but at the time, you know, in this project, it was about privacy. So we brought the designers in, we brought the regulators in, or ex-regulators, and had them build prototypes together. And even though they didn't have that language, the shared language at the beginning, through the prototypes, they started to understand each other. And at the end, they understood, what do I mean when I say that? What do I mean when I ask that question?
Yeah.
Because they were in the teams together, they were proud of the prototypes. And even if you, and this doesn't mean that you solve the issues that you're having in this one prototyping workshop. What you're doing is you build a base for the rest of your project that people actually know, have, you know, communication, and they know what they mean, what they talk about.
Yeah. Marcus, we're coming towards the end of the episode. There's lots more that we could speak about a little bit more, but you're also, yourself and Adam run the Global Service Jam. Is there a Service Jam on the horizon?
Oh, yes. There is a Service Jam coming up in almost 2 months. I think even a bit less than 2 months in March, from the 16th to the 20th of March. So if you're remotely interested in prototyping, because this, you know, the Service Jam actually started because at the time, 10 years ago, prototyping and service design was the final frontier. People knew how to prototype products, but they didn't have such a grasp on services. So we said we need to build a sandbox where we can try these things.
Yeah, and that's what it is. I'll throw a link to that one into the show notes. People want to reach out to you, you know, here's Mini, the prototype of Marcus, the latest prototype. You want to say hello?
Magst du hallo sagen?
Magst du das jetzt die
Älter? Hey, it's the youngest guest on This Is HCD.
That's my daughter. And I think she wants to watch, I think, something with Anna and Elsa. That's what I heard.
Ah, Elsa.
It's the big,
very cool.
It's a big thing. Yeah, we're just listening to the music right now. So,
oh, very good. Well, look, Marcus, I'll let you go back to your day. As always, I love speaking with you. And if people want to reach out to you, I'll put a link to your website, Workplay Experience, and also you're working Twitter on some handle. Prototyping courses for This Is Doing as well. So hopefully, have those in some point in the next couple of months. But thanks so much for your time, Marcus.
No, thank you for having me. That's great. Thank you so much, Jerry. Take care.
So there you have it. That's all for this episode of Bringing Design Closer. If you like this episode, feel free to visit thisishcd.com, where you can access our back catalogue of over 100 episodes, with episodes related to service design, product management, design research, and much, much more. If you're interested in design and innovation training, feel free to check out our business, thisisdoing.com, where you can join online classrooms and learn from the world's best design and innovation leaders. Join the This Is HCD newsletter, where you'll receive updates from the network. And also, if you're interested, apply to join the Slack community on thisishcd.com. Stay safe, and until next time, take care.